but it gives me a time to talk about Ukraine. Say, oh, I didn't know this. So it's like ambassadorial, but it's fashion. So there are people who are interested in these Vishivankas who don't know anything about Ukraine, but it gives me an opportunity to talk. So.
Hey there, Slavic Connection listeners. The episode you're about to hear was recorded in front of a live audience and is a part of our expert speaker series presented by Hashtag Connections.
So one of the things that I wanted to do before the war started was I wanted to start a tourism business and take people into the Carpathians. But then Russians came as unwanted tourists and it split everything.
It's not a typical Texas.
You're listening to The Slavic Connection, brought to you by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies and the William P. Clement Center for National Security at the University of Texas at Austin.
All right, thank you very much for having me at UT Texas. What was interesting about walking here was that I realized I had on a lot of clothes and it was pretty warm. So I came from New York in a winter coat and immediately regretted not taking it off when I got off the plane. So that was my Texas welcome. But no, I'm really happy to be here and talk about Ukraine. And I think a lot of you all followed me at the start of the war, of the invasion, of the Russian invasion. Most people saw me on MSNBC and CNN primarily because people thought that I was actually employed with these organizations. In fact, I was not employed with either of them. Nonetheless, they treated me like it. So I was able to do a lot of coverage with this phone. So everything that you saw from me came from this iPhone 13 Plus. I feel like a lot of people were really drawn to my work because I gave this kind of view that everyone else would do if they were in the war, because most people don't have large camcorders or video recording devices. And so they would have this phone. And I felt like that added to the texture of the environment. Right now it's more than 2 years later and we have a vastly different relationship with Ukraine and with the coverage. At first, when the war started, when the invasion started, there were a lot of people who were asking whether Ukraine would hold, and American intelligence services and agencies were fearing that Ukraine would fall in 3 days. And while I was doing interviews leading up to that point, people were asking me in shock, why are you still there? And I said that everything about Ukraine falling in 3 days or that this country would not hold, I didn't believe it. And I believe that for reasons I didn't understand at the time, that either the Western intelligence was bad, it was incomplete, or both. But I wanted to stay because I wanted to capture the resistance. And I wanted to document it while I was there. And also, I wanted to really document stories from a Ukrainian perspective. The way that I do journalism is that I focus on communities as if they were my own. So I come from a tradition of Black media. Much of my experience does not come from mainstream media outlets. It doesn't come from working in traditional newsrooms. I've worked pretty much at media publications, or Black-run media publications that focus on Black American media. Or I've worked at places like Univision that have a focus on Spanish-speaking communities. And so the vast majority of my career has been devoted to covering people, covering politics from a non-white male perspective. And that really has prepared me for the work that I'm currently doing in Ukraine. And it helps me to understand Ukraine because in my own work in America, I really focus on really decentering whiteness in the coverage and centering people whose stories are not commonly told or mistold. And I feel like from an international relations standpoint, Ukraine fits within that within that framework, because I, in addition to my graduate program education, I have one master's degree similar to the center that's hosting me. And you all know that they usually start off with Russia, right? Russian, East European, Eurasian studies. And now the field is rethinking the renaming of their centers and really rethinking about what does it mean for a field that's long been dominated by Russianists to rethink and recenter itself, right? And I go back to that those assessments of Ukraine supposedly falling in 3 days. And I concluded that a lot of the reasons why the intelligence was incomplete because there weren't analysts that understand Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian people. And you look at some of the names that speak before Congress in hearings and talking about this subject in hindsight, and many of them, because of the Cold War, et cetera, they focus on Russia, right? But what this war is really, this invasion is really, really conditioning us all to do is to really have really difficult conversations about what it means to decolonize conversations, what does it mean to decenter power structures. So just for the sake of this talk, because I'm going to be talking about the election, the way that I talk about decentering traditional power structures, I feel, you know, and also observing the ways in which the Russian dictator Vladimir Putin talks about Russians, I'm going to compare Russianness and whiteness, because I feel like they essentially function as the same thing. Because we're talking, you know, more of an academic term, we're talking about hegemonies, right? I think that there is Western hegemony. I think that there, you know, also there is Russian hegemony. There is, in the context of Asia, there's Chinese hegemony when you think about the regions there, right? And so in order for me to help people understand the work that I do, I start with something that they know and then I expand into it. And so it's my way of really deconstructing Ukraine and the genocide that they're experiencing and making it understandable to American audiences. I think, so I'll start off by talking about my work. And before I get into the election, people ask me, how did you get into Ukraine? And so and then I'll talk about what does foreign policy mean within the context of Ukraine. So the abridged version of it was that I was in the summer before my senior year, I applied for an international program to study abroad. On the application, it asks you, where would you like to go? I found one particular program that I would be interested in. I was accepted. But on the application, it asks you to pick the regions. I picked all the Black countries. And then when I got the acceptance letter, it said Russia, which I had no interest in going. And so, mind you, I went to a historically Black school. I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, you know, primarily led a Black life. And then, you know, eventually I went. This is before I understood Russia to as I knew it right now, but I went and it was a constructive experience. I applied for Peace Corps and I was supposed to go to Russia, but that program was canceled. And then I ended up going to Georgia. And so when I went to Georgia, what I found something that was really fascinating was that it expanded my understanding of race. And expanding my understanding of whiteness. And just by virtue of being a Black person, people in Georgia responded to me differently. And they would just casually talk to me about being Black in Russia. And I looked at these people and I said, you're not Black, right? The longer I lived there, the longer I began to understand the Georgian language and talk to people, the more I understood how people from the Caucasus and Central Asia are contextualized and racialized within the context of Russia regionally. And so that was really fascinating to me. And I wanted to learn because it really helped me to grow personally. And it made me want to understand the world in ways that I never understood it before I entered Georgia. And so after I finished my Peace Corps experience in Georgia, I applied for graduate school and I became interested in Ukraine. and went in 2008 just to see if I would like it. And then I said, okay, I did. And I applied for a Fulbright and I started focusing on Afro-Ukrainians. And so that was my Fulbright project. And I did a photojournalism exhibition. So, well, I'll tell you some things that struck out to me that helped to prepare me for the work that I'm doing and helping to explain this election, why we all should be thinking about it. The theme of my talk essentially is we all need to be invested in each other's safety and security. But there is one pivotal moment in Ukraine that really made me have a deeper connection with Ukraine. And I was in Lviv walking down the street and I was with my Peace Corps, not Peace Corps, but my Fulbright colleagues. We're at a conference. About 30 of us were kind of walking down the street and some older guy weaved through the crowd and he approached me specifically. And he extended his hand. He said, well, Terrell, how you doing? He didn't know my name, but he said, hey, how you doing? Do you speak Russian or Ukrainian? Interesting fact. In the early stages of the Fulbright, the program paid for Russian and did not pay for Ukrainian. They pay for Ukrainian now. So I said Russian. And he said, well, do you want to know the history of our country? So who asks you just randomly on the street, do you want to know the history of our country? But it sounds kind of odd, but it actually happened. So this old dude is looking at me and people started turning around and looking at us have this conversation because it's just so random. And I said, well, no. And then he goes on into the history of Ukraine, right? And mind you, I'm not some native Russian speaker, but I'm following him. But what he started off by saying was, he said, his first words were, Ukraine is a colony of Moscow. And these Russians want to colonize us and enslave us. And he was specifically referring to Rostva, you know, which is slavery in Russian. And so before he could really get into it, one of my Fulbright colleagues politely interjected and pulled me along because he was going to keep me there for an hour or so, you know? So, but the point of it was that I kept having these experiences and it made me realize what my unique purpose was and stationed in this region. And so there are a lot of people who do great work. They do a lot of work documenting, war crimes. They work at these major outlets where they do talk about the inner politics with Zaluzhny and Zelensky and all these other figures. But whenever I'm asked to talk about Ukraine, they ask me about my personal experience. And because I care, it made them care. And so that tends to be the genesis of how I approach any conversation around Ukraine. And I find it to be even more important in today's time. As we talk about this election. And so 2 years later after this war, there is much less enthusiasm for understanding Ukraine because contrary to the popular belief of our intelligence agencies, Ukraine did not fall in 3 days. And so the whole conversation is, okay, Ukraine stands. And so people don't have a narrative to really clench on anymore. And I think that our media could do a better job of giving people stories to continue to be interested in, right? Because the whole story is that Ukraine was supposed to fall. It didn't fall. They're defending themselves as best they can. Now what? So I'm going to tell you about why I think Ukraine is important within this context. This is a foreign policy election. There have been fewer moments in the past 30 years, the past 60 years, where foreign policy has been at the center point of our local and national elections. In addition to Ukraine, you have other conflicts that have really taken up space in the conversation. That includes what's going on in Gaza. You have Sudan. You have Haiti. You have the constant chatter about a possible conflict between the United States and China over Taiwan. And so you have this major confluence of foreign affairs issues that are happening now that didn't exist at the start of the Russian invasion in February of 2024. At this intersection is white nationalism. So Donald Trump has really, in his MAGA contingency, has put Ukraine's sovereignty at risk for the sake of satisfying white fear. That's where the intersection is. And people ask, why? How are you drawing these connections? Well, again, as a reporter who has covered the past two elections in 2016 and 2020, in addition to this one, and as somebody who's been on the road and going from one little small town to the next across America, I can definitely tell you from my own reporting and my own experiences is that you have a MAGA contingency that is very devoted to fascism and nationalism. These are terms that we use for countries outside of America. No one ever associates fascism or the terms threat to democracy to the United States of America, because we were supposed to be above it. Now, what's interesting is that Black Americans, Latinx communities have always known that democracy has always been under attack because of threats to our voting rights, threats to our bodies via most recently, or the one that took international attention was George Floyd, right? And so we've always seen a threat to democracy in our lives. This is the first time where we've seen the intersection of foreign affairs and domestic white nationalist politics coming together, and where we can find a very concrete example in which that white nationalism is directly harming people who aren't Black or people who aren't people of color. The reason, and the number one reason why Ukraine is not getting its aid, is because a racist has determined that it's not America first. That's the reason why Ukraine is not getting its aid. And that person who started off that campaign was a racist bigot out of Florida by the name of Matt Gaetz. We used a very simple rule within the procedures of the House to threaten and depose the House Speaker, former House Speaker McCarthy out of California. So right now, part of that racist holding of Ukraine hostage has been connected to the border. And as you all know, this is Texas. And so Texas is a border state. And so your governor, Abbott, and by the way, I always think when I talk to different people about the room, and regardless of what your political ideology is, there's no way that I can avoid this conversation because you have to take it head on. So I'm just giving you straight facts. So it's not a partisan issue. This is just facts. The governor has, in a very strategic manner, bussed migrants from Texas to cities like Chicago, where I've been recently, to New York, where I'm from, to California and other states, in an effort to ratchet up campaign dialogues about sanctuary cities and how dangerous they are by using racist tropes to describe people from south of the border and busing them into cities that are run by Black mayors. If you notice, many of these cities that these people are being bused to are run by Black American officials. And so right now, in order for Mike Johnson to even introduce the bill that the Senate approved that has more than $60 million for Ukraine, Mike Johnson, and he alone, is deciding that we must do something to protect our borders. In reality, the situation at the border, and this is not something that I'm going to be talking about because it's not the purpose of the talk, but I think you all know very well that while the policy for the border can be improved, there are a lot of racist, there's a lot of racist commentary about people south of the border that is exciting these talks of putting up a wall, right? And so they definitely mesh quite conveniently with the racism that's directed to Chicago when we talk about crime or New York City. And so this is, and so until that element of the MAGA agenda is satisfied, there will be no aid for Ukraine. So literally people are dying in Ukraine and not getting the necessary military aid that it needs because of white supremacy. So why am I saying all this? As much as I enjoy Ukraine, some of the problems that I've had have been that many of the Ukrainian officials that I communicate with, and many of whom have studied in the United States, I mean, studied at the best institutions in New York and Washington, D.C., anywhere across the country, I find that many of them have not really taken the time to understand our country beyond the think tank institutions that invite them to speak and the universities at which they matriculate. And so when they go back to Ukraine or to Poland or where else, they lack an understanding of how race determines the politics of our country. And if you don't understand race in America, you don't know anything about America. You know nothing about this country if you don't understand race. So there are a lot of highly educated people who matriculate at our great institutions, but they don't understand people. Why did I talk to you all about understanding people at the beginning? About understanding intelligence? If you don't spend time with people, you're not going to get the best intelligence. You're not going to get the best read of what's happening because you have a very limited understanding and a very closeted, and you have very, very insular relationships, which doesn't help you to get the full picture. So just as our intelligence community and our officials did not get the full picture on Ukraine, if we don't talk about the white supremacy and the racism that is fueling Donald Trump's MAGA campaign against people south of the border, which inevitably is impacting Ukraine, you're not going to have the best understanding of the way to respond. So we usually think about white supremacy impacting Latinx people and Black people and LGBTQ plus community. Well, Ukrainians are getting a feel of what that means right now in this very moment. And what's really troubling me about all of this in this election cycle is that we're not really making those connections enough. And so what that means is that until we learn as people how to be invested in each other's safety, none of us are going to be safe. And at the start of the war, when I would talk about how some of the racism that African refugees were facing leaving Ukraine and going into Europe, that really drew a lot of negative reactions from me because they felt like I was spreading Russian propaganda, et cetera. And I had to explain to people that anti-Blackness and racism is everywhere. You know, hello, America, right? It was an opportunity for us to talk about how we could better treat each other. That's ultimately where this all comes down to. And if we have knee-jerk reactions anytime we're challenged to self-reflect, then problems like this are going to fester. And so this message of talking about white supremacy is really about being aware and asking each other, how do we come together to combat it? Because another person who is actually a supremacist that Trump gets along well with is the Russian supremacist Vladimir Putin. He is one of the most ethnic supremacist people on the face of this earth. So when people were, and I'm going to again draw another intersection with this election. When I reflect back on why the CIA analysts got Ukraine wrong, I wonder if they looked at Ukrainian local news, where people were constantly talking about how much they would resist, or when they saw old grandmothers with their children at firing ranges getting their kids adjusted to firing rifles. Or did they listen to Putin's talks beyond the 30-minute or the 30-second sound bites that are on CNN and MSNBC and listen to the whole 10 to 15 minutes where he essentially talks about Ukrainians like they're white trash? I mean, I would not know how I would feel if someone told me that my country and my culture does not exist. So basically, as I would stay with my friends, as I was staying, living with my friends in Kyiv, and listening to these radio announcements, that gave me really important context about the psyche of Russian president or dictator Vladimir Putin. And so Vladimir Putin, like Donald Trump, has put together a political trinity. And Trump, who doesn't care about the church, has pretty much coalesced a political powerhouse of white evangelicals to use God to justify his racism. In addition to the church, he has used the far right in order to magnify his messages. And in the case of Mike Johnson and his presidency, he took control of the state. So that's your trinity: the state, the far right, and the church. Putin also uses the Russian Orthodox Church, the far right, and for more than 20 years, the state. And in the middle of that, handling the media ecosystem is the man formerly employed at Fox, Tucker Carlson, who has built relationships with the far right in Europe, namely with Viktor Orban. And also in this recent interview with Putin, an interview that I have gone out of my way to not watch, but for a number of reasons, I have to go back, I have to eventually watch it. But my point is that what Trump is doing is not just specific to the United States of America. He wants to unite with the far right globally. You all heard Dmitry Medvedev's speech where he said that Russia has no borders. So one of the things that these people have in common, and I know whiteness is something that doesn't necessarily fit every place, but in a sense it does. One of the things that Viktor Orban, Le Pen in France, who is threatening to, has a strong possibility of running again and threatening to take on the presidency in France, other far right leaders and Putin, what they all have in common is that they all have a siege mentality. And what they value most collectively is their whiteness. They are coalescing around this. And so I think the most responsible thing that I could do as a journalist who's been to Ukraine, who observes how Russia talks about Ukraine, how Trump coalesces around leaders of the, you know, far right leaders around the world, is what are we doing as a United States audience to respond to that? And so this election is a foreign policy election, but more specifically, the centerpiece of it is global white nationalism. And if Donald Trump wins, he is going to be the ringleader of it. And so it won't just be Mike Johnson saying no. It will be President Trump, who will no longer be the whip of NATO, and in fact has recently said that he would allow Putin to attack NATO countries that don't, quote unquote, pay their fair share, which is a bullshit, you know, commentary for a number of reasons. But you all have a say collectively in how to respond to this. It doesn't matter what race you are. It doesn't matter if you're from the Latinx community, Asian, if you're Black, if you're white, whatever, however you're Ukrainian, however you describe yourself. This white nationalist, MAGA-driven agenda of America first will not only threaten the sovereignty of Ukraine, it will jeopardize security relationships with the rest of the world. And so the white nationalism that was so specific to us has gone global. And you don't have to look like us to have your life and your sovereignty threatened by the white supremacy that has attacked our communities for so many years. And so I'll end by saying that the way that we, you know, people ask me what is foreign policy, and I'd say it's really simple. It's a global version of urban planning. This university, the parks in Austin, the schools, the business sector, homes, all of these things are planned. This city was planned. Foreign policy is a global version of it. So my goal is to demystify the conversations of how we all can engage this subject. I don't think anyone has to be a subject expert in Ukraine in order to appreciate how important it is for us to care about it. Because the white nationalist fervor that is holding up aid for Ukraine can be used for other countries. If you don't think you're next, I would look at the Ukrainians who never thought that they would be impacted by it. So foreign policy is really one of the subjects where we all can engage. We all have a right to talk about the morality of how our world ought to be run. And so that's the way that I start off with it. And so with my reporting that I do every week, and I encourage you all to go to Black Diplomats Official on YouTube and my Black Diplomats Substack and my Black Diplomats podcasts, where I do weekly interviews about Ukraine. My journalism is really about us caring about each other and being very clear about the threats that impact us all. And so I started off in this part of the world, really being afraid of going to a country that I never heard of and never contemplated visiting. And I'm talking about Russia, and then ultimately going to Georgia and to Central Asia, where I visit every year, and then where I spend much of my time now in Ukraine. These are countries where I felt like I didn't have a place. And now, some 20 years later, I feel like Ukraine is the exact place I need to be to tell the story of how we can be better human beings to one another. And that's what my journalism is about. So I thank you all for listening to me, and I'll take any questions that you all have.
The Slavic Connection is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this program represent the views of the hosts and the guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit us online at slavxradio.com. Thank you.
The Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies condemns the Russian Federation's military invasion of Ukraine. We stand in support of the people of Ukraine who are fighting for their lives and sovereignty in the face of the unjustified invasion by Russian military forces.
Let's go ahead and start off now. Get right in. Yeah, why not? We can stay right here. It's just totally.